All right, I propose that we call this to order and begin. Good morning, everyone. Good to see you again in session. It's a great pleasure to introduce to you our very own Dr. Greg Sadler. He's at Marquette, but also at the Walton Institute of Art and Design. And he's going to be presenting this morning the significance of Filmos, Chronic Aristotelian Modal Psychology.
Thanks. All right, so this is working. So I have to begin with two provisos or apologies. I'm going to do something a little bit different, but not totally different from what was promised in the abstract, because I'm going to discuss Plato and Aristotle, but also more than briefly contrast these with other Hellenistic later schools and authors and other broadly Platonic responses. And the project, as is often the case, is a little less comprehensive and organized than I would like at this point. So what it is mostly is working notes at this point. I don't have a paper. The handout is rather rudimentary. My motivation for this is part of a larger project. I'm very interested in ancient and medieval accounts of anger as a passion. So Thumos obviously fits in with that. And I also, you know, like to, this leads into many rabbit holes, actually, do work in the history of ideas, tracing out these sort of developments and polemics and borrowings and contrasts. And when it comes to Thumos, that's part of what we observe in the history of ideas. I also think that it's a particularly timely thing to talk about. In part, I'm sure many of you are aware of sort of scholarly or semi-scholarly discussions of Thumos. Francis Fukuyama discusses this in The End of History and The Last Man. Harvey Mansfield had a book, you know, saying we've neglected Thumos. And there's many others as well. And there was a book in the early 2000s by Barbara Kosiak called Retrieving Political Emotion, Thumos, Aristotle, and Gender, which was quite good on the, not just Thumos, but the emotions in general. But if you look up this term and you Google it, you're going to find that it's referenced quite a lot in what you can call the manosphere, this whole set of blogs and YouTube channels. And they're picking up on the idea of Thumos. So it'd be kind of nice to actually have a better, you know, understanding of it than we should all be these warrior types, angry all the time. We have to recover this vital element of us that's been lost. When it comes to this matter in terms of ancient philosophy and also to some degree medical authors, there's two different stories that could be told. And I think that one of the we could call it the quick and easy story is, well, you've got Plato, and he's got the three parts of the soul, and Thumos is the middle part, and, it has to align with reason against the passions, and we learn all that in studying the Republic, and then maybe see something similar in the Phaedrus. And then there's Aristotle, and Aristotle doesn't take Thumos to be a middle part of the soul. Instead, he makes it one type of orexis, or part of the orecticon. But he still privileges, in some respect, the emotion of anger in that, he sees the need to discuss it in terms of a specific virtue of prautes. And then we get, the Hellenistic authors who are much more interested in ataraxia. So that would be the Epicureans and the Stoics. And for them, anger is bad. And then the thing just kind of lies dormant until you see later Christian authors, primarily Greeks, talking about Thumos. But then they don't have much impact on the West until later on we see people like Aquinas talking about the irascible orexis, right? And they're, none of those things are completely off, but they're not a fuller part of the story, because what we see is that it never really goes away, and it remains an issue of contention between all these different schools. And there are some, later Platonic accounts that will they're usually labeled as eclectic, so a lot of people, you just sort of ignore them. But they're very interesting because what they're doing is trying to take, you know, Plato's tripartite soul and find ways to bring in insights from the Stoics, from Aristotle in particular, and, you know, produce some sort of cohesive account. And try it also quite often to understanding of the body and its organs. So some of these Platonic accounts seem to even extend Aristotelian insights within a developing Platonic framework. And then that gets incorporated into Christian frameworks. So when we see, you know, Christian authors from Lactantius onward discussing these issues, it's not just sort of taking, you know, Plato's three parts of the soul in a very crude way and adapting it. It's part of this long current of discussion. So in what I'm doing here, I'm not going to be analyzing claims and arguments. Maybe we do that in the Q&A and discussion, or evidence or anything, or saying who's right or wrong, you know, whether Plato's right in arguing there's three parts of the soul. I'm more interested in just sort of tracing out the history of the notion of thumos as thinkers respond to each other. And I think that it's, you know, even in the accounts that we have, it remains pretty underdetermined. We have to do a lot of reading things in and connecting dots. And this is in part because thumos is, this is the one positive thing that I'll say that I think. Thumos is something that we're constantly trying to make sense out of. You know, philosophy is in part about trying to make sense out of ourselves and what's going on with our own psyches and the world and other people and relations. And these doctrines that these philosophers have are sort of their best shots at making sense of it and putting it into some sort of systematic form. I do have to say a few preliminaries. One is that when it comes to vocabulary, Greek, as many of you know, has a very extensive vocabulary of what we can call anger spectrum or related terms. Thumos is part of that. And even in Plato and Aristotle, sometimes thumos and the other really big heavy hitter word, orge, get used just as synonyms for each other. So, you know, we have to be attentive to that. In other cases, thumos is something of wider extent in the soul, the thumoeides, or just thumos by itself with orge or other variants of that being part of that. In a few cases, orge is actually the sort of genus term, and then there are species. For example, for the Stoics, there are species of orge, and thumos is just one of those. So it's not as if there's some sort of standard accepted linguistic practice. I also wanted to mention that there's a lot of different ways of translating thumos and thumoeides into English, and many of us, I'm sure when we've taught Republic Book 4, have had to, you know, make all these sort of what would you call them? Suggestions to students when they see the word passion or spirit, not to immediately associate it with something else. It's not an easy term to translate. Sometimes it gets translated as just the irascible faculty, and that's not bad. Two other interesting translations that I found that I actually like a bit better. One is that it's the meddlesome. M-E-T-T-L-E, not metal as in meddling, but meddlesome part. The translator of Plutarch's On Restraining Anger, I'll look that up later, translates it that way. And then in the Philokalia English translation, you see it translated as the incandescent part. And I think that's a nice translation of thumos as well. The other last preliminary I wanted to say is when it comes to anger in general and also this issue of thumos, we know that we're missing a very significant portion of the literature that was written on it. So the picture that we're putting together is fragmentary in a second sense as well. It could be that we find some you know, new scrolls or something like that. I'd love to see that. And, you know, we find out exactly what Theophrastus thought about it, or we find out more about the Epicurean account. But until that happens, we just have to work with the text that we have. So let's talk about Plato first. Plato says that thumos is this third part in Republic 439e. He mentions it as thumos, and that with which we get angry. The phrase is where he says that with which we get angry. In this case, it's whole thumometha, so it's not the part that we get angry with in terms of orge, but in terms of getting riled up. It's been pointed out that Plato's definitely not the first person to use thumos. There's that famous passage by Heraclitus that everybody in the literature, the ancient literature cites at one point or another. The playwrights talked about it in Euripides' Medea. You see a conflict between thumos and reason on her part. And it played a big role in Homer as well, but nobody did any sort of systematic treatment of it. Plato is the first to do anything like that, as far as we know. And we can ask some big questions that I think are worth reflecting on. We don't have to do this thematically with each person, but we can ask these questions about thumos with Plato. So first of all, what is thumos? What is its ontological status? Another question, well, what does it actually do? What is its function or its work? And then how does it actually work? That's where they often get pretty hazy. We don't get a lot of explanations of that. And then there's another fundamental question that's going to divide ancient philosophers. Is thumos something good or is it something bad? Or is it something in between? And we see Plato attending to this. How is thumos improved or developed or worsened? And where he does this the most is really just three texts. There's the Republic. Not just Book 4, but several others as well. There's the Phaedrus, but the Phaedrus, as we're going to see, is a little bit of a... it's not that helpful. It doesn't fill in the picture that well. And then there's the Timaeus, and the Timaeus is particularly important because it's going to tie these faculties to the body and to organs. So... The most important features of the Platonic account is, of course, the tripartite soul. And then the identification and account of thumos's characteristic province or domain or objects. There's a positive valuation of thumos connected to the account of good practical reasoning and moral development. There's a negative valuation of thumos insofar as it's given free rein and elevated into something like a value in its own right, like was done in the previous culture and in much of Plato's contemporary culture. And there's identification of some individuals as being more thumotic, as being more thumos-driven than others, and others as lacking thumos. So if we turn to the Republic, Book 4, the parts and the activities of the soul, we're all familiar with the argument about opposites. The same thing will not do or suffer opposites in the same respect in relation to the same thing at the same time. So Plato uses this to argue for a plurality of parts to the soul. And, first the account develops reason and the appetites, epithumiae. And then we have thumos. Thumos is what we feel anger with, or we get thumotic with, quite literally. It's a third distinct part. He rejects that thumos could possibly be an epithumia. Why? Because it can resist the epithumiae. It can in some way choke them off, you could say. And then when we look at Book 9, there's a nice supplement to this. He tells us what thumos is concerned with in very clear terms. It's concerned with predominance, kraten. It's concerned with victory or striving for that, nikon. It's concerned with good repute, eudokumene, and it's concerned with honor, he says. So also with, you could say, with ambition, philotimon. And that gives us a good sense of what this part of ourselves is doing. And, again, this is, I'm just sort of, bringing owls to Athens in this case, right? What does the thumos do? It allows us to be angry with the appetites in ourself. It can ally with the rational faculty. It's aroused when a person thinks or feels themselves wronged or gets angry. It also can get angry, as he says in book four, when we're suffering hunger or cold, unless we view that as just. We know that children have thumos, but not yet reason. And what is its function? It's supposed to, ideally, enforce the rule of reason upon the appetites. That's one central function. It's supposed to help us to be good practical reasoners, not just, you know, thinking about things, but actually doing things. And then it's directed outward towards others. It's the virtue that is that courage. It's the part that the virtue of courage either develops in or doesn't develop in. Plato also tells us a couple other things that are kind of interesting about it. There is a discussion of geographic or what we might call ethnic determinism, which we see running through him and Aristotle. We don't see this in the later stuff because, of course, all of them would be more or less barbarians, you know, by comparison. But he thinks that, you know, there's a lot of thumos in the Thracians and the Scythians and those in the northern lands. He also tells us very importantly in book five that women vary just like men do in that some are more thumotic and some are less thumotic. So although thumos is associated with masculinity, and, you know, some people even translate it as manly spirit or things like that, Plato doesn't see it that way in particular. He also talks about thumos being irresistible and invincible, something that will come up in Aristotle later as well. Why would thumos be something bad? We've been talking it up quite a bit. Well, it can be corrupted by evil nurture. When thumos is not being properly located in relation to reason and the appetites, then it's going to go bad. In book two, there's this challenge of making people calm, he says, praun, and also at the same time, megalothumon, in their character, their ethos. And how do we do this? Plato says that, well, gymnastics plays some role, but you don't want to emphasize that too much. Instead, musike is going to play a central role, and I'm looking forward to hearing the paper on music later, and philosophy. So that's supposed to retrain thumos into what it ought to be. In book eight, we see this whole sequence of degeneration. The first degeneration is that you have these rulers who are more thumotic, more suited to war than peace, preferring, as he says, gymnastics to music, contentious and desirous of honor. In book nine, he clarifies for us that every single part of the soul, of these three parts, has its own distinctive kinds of pleasures and its own desire. And so he talks about the honor-loving person. And the honor-loving person is, in some respect, effective. They're not as defective as the person who's driven primarily by epithumia, but they are defective in relation to the person who's primarily oriented by the rational part. In the Phaedrus, you know, we have another tripartite model of the soul with the metaphor of the chariot drivers and horses. And Plato says basically that it's unfortunate not to be a god because the gods have, you know, great horses. We have these horses that we're working with. And the story that's told here is of an idealized thumos. Because if you think about it, the good horse is a thumos, if it is thumos, it's a thumos in proper condition. It's not the thumos that, you know, tries to take over or anything like that. There's some interesting personifications and in account of the soul and the face of the beloved. He tells us that the good horse gets ashamed and amazed and that it wets the soul with sweat. Interestingly, it's not the good horse who gets angry. It's actually the bad horse. And he uses the word orge in there in that discussion of that. So I don't know that the Phaedrus, if we're just considering Plato on his own, is actually that helpful. In the Timaeus, in 69 to 70, we get some additional discussion that's quite interesting. He mentions thumos first as one of the emotions and not as a part. He talks about anger that's hard to be appeased. But then he talks about the part that partakes in courage, spirit, and desires victory. And he locates it right here, right below the neck, so it can better listen to the head where reason is. And it's located in the heart. Very clear, explicit identification of that. That will run throughout the entire tradition of discussing thumos all the way into the early Christian authors. And he says that it's there so that when the heat of the passion boils up, as soon as reason passes the word around that some unjust action is being done which affects them either from without or possibly even from the interior desires, every organ of sense in the body might quickly perceive through all the channels the injunctions and the threats and always obey and follow them, thus allowing their best part. He also says that, interestingly, the lungs are there to help out. So there's another organ that plays a role. If thumos gets too excited, sort of like think about the lungs as kind of like a radiator. Now, when we turn to Aristotle, we have a second main perspective on thumos, which differs from that but follows along with some, in some respects, with the Platonic treatment of, of thumos. Thumos is no longer a part of the soul, with the implications of having some independence, but it's rather one type or mode of something else, which is orexis. And it centers particularly in the dynamic of the complex emotion of anger, but it's also concerned with social status, position, striving, contending. It does not have a role or function of enforcing reason's rule on the appetites. That's a major difference right there. We're dealing with a very different psychology in many respects. Boulesis, this other part of orexis, that doesn't give orders either. The rational part does. Proiresis, something that Plato is not dealing with at all, assumes a central role in choice or commitment. There's no, discussion, as I mentioned, of thumos imposing orders. And if we want to, there's a lot of ways to go at this. And so I thought it'd be good to start with some places where somebody might say, yeah, but Aristotle actually does talk about the thumotic part. So if we look at topics 4, Aristotle references the thumoeides in 2 different discussions. Both of these are about how to handle arguments that your opponents are making. He says, if your opponent said hatred follows anger, then hatred would be in the spirited faculty, for anger is in that faculty. You must look whether it's contrary. Friendship is also in it, for if it's not there, but in the appetitive faculty, hatred cannot follow anger. Aristotle's not committing himself to anything there. He's discussing stuff using a terminology that other people apparently at the time are using. There's also a similar discussion about whether shame, fear, and anger are types of pain. Then Aristotle says, but shame would be in the logistikon, fear in the thumoeides, pain in the epithumetikon, and anger also in the thumoeides. I don't think that we should take this as Aristotle committing to any sort of tripartite psychology there. Because in De Anima 3, there's an explicit discussion of the Platonic tripartite account, where he talks about the logistikon, the thumikon, and the epithumetikon. And he says that there are other parts we can't assign to any of these 3 parts, like the phantastikon, and the orektikon would be in all 3, since boulesis is in the logistikon, and thumos and epithumia are in the logon. So that makes it pretty clear that Aristotle is not taking on Plato's tripartite psychology, and he sees it as inadequate. So he's proposing something different instead, which is that there's this thing that we call orexis or the orektikon, and it has these different modes. Somebody might respond and say, well, wait a second, there's also Politics 7. Aristotle tells us that people who are to be guided to virtue by the lawgiver need to be dianoetikos and thumoeides in their nature, like the Greeks, of course. And he tells us there that thumos is productive of to philetikon, affection. He goes on to say that from this dunamis, thumos, comes rulership, to archon, and the desire for freedom, to eleutheron. But I don't see any problem reconciling that with the psychology that Aristotle's providing, you know, through the rest of his works, I don't think that the mere mention of thumoeides has to make us think that there's a sort of Platonic soul. Because Aristotle consistently makes a threefold distinction in the De Anima, both ethics and the rhetoric, and even in the politics, where he's saying that there's three main modes of orexis. By the way, you know, he says that over and over again, children have the logis, mos, or nous only later, but they have thumos already. So what should we say about the orexis? It plays a central role in human movement. It's central to us in the De Anima as self-moved movers and in the Nicomachean Ethics. In Rhetoric Book 1, in the discussion of judicial rhetoric, he has this interesting passage where he talks about seven causes, and he uses the word idea there, of human actions, chance, nature, compulsion, habit. And then he says the logismon, a little bit earlier he talks about boulesis, so we've got that as one mode of orexis, thumos and epithumia. And so those are the things that move us. Unfortunately for us, Aristotle devotes a lot of analysis to, well, not a lot of analysis, some analysis to boulesis and to epithumia, but frustratingly not that much to thumos. We could perhaps read in Rhetoric Book 1, Chapter 11, where he's discussing the things that we take pleasure in, and they're all thumotic things, timoresis, victory, superiority, you know, huperoke. He uses the word epithumia there, where we would hope to see thumos, and he follows that up with discussions of honor and reputation, and the friend is pleasant things. So maybe that's, you know, we'd say, well, he messed up a little bit there. But he doesn't really provide us with any sort of overview. Instead, we have a few scattered passages. There are some passages that do discuss and reference thumos. Most importantly, I would say, is this discussion of akrasia, right, which we see in both the Nicomachean Ethics and a little bit in the, bless you, Eudaimian Ethics. It's one of the things that akrasia can occur in relation to. And he tells us that a few interesting things. One is that thumos, and he doesn't use the word orge there, he uses thumos, syllogizes. It engages in some sort of reasoning process in Book 7. But it goes from what logos or phantasia provides it, and then it you know, leads us to the conclusion of I better punish or retaliate against this person. This is part of what he uses to argue that akrasia with respect to anger or thumos is not as bad as akrasia in other respects. He thinks that it's more closely connected to the rational than is epithumia, right? Because it follows reason or the rational part in a certain way, pos. He also, though, distinguishes time, nike, and even, you know, a preoccupation with children and parents as objects of akrasia. So I think that in the Nicomachean Ethics Book 7 section, we probably should read this as akrasia in respect of anger rather than of all the different things that thumos could be concerned with. And I think one bit of evidence for this, it really depends on what you think of the problems, is that in Problems 28, this topic is also raised almost word for word, but uses orge instead of thumos. That depends on whether the problems are actually Aristotelian, though, right? So, but it would be, you know, broadly Aristotelian. In Nicomachean Ethics Book 3, you know, he clarifies that thumos is not proeresis, in part because animals have thumos, but they don't have proeresis. Again, he makes the distinction between boulesis, thumos, and epithumia there. Also in Book 3, he has that section where he talks about it being related to, but not being the same thing as courage. So thumos makes humans and animals able to deal with threats or challenges or danger. And interestingly, he tells us that in order for it to really be courage, you would have to do two things. You would have to add proeresis to it, and it would have to be oriented towards to kalon and do as reason says, instead of being sort of a more instinctual response. For Aristotle, thumos also plays a role, like with Plato, of leading us astray. in the politics, this passage, I think, came up yesterday, the discussion of why the law should rule. He tells us that Thumos presents a problem there, even for the Aristos Andra, right? Why should law rule? It's nous aneu orexis, right? Mind lacking desire or affectivity. In Politics, Book 5, he talks about how Thumos makes people ready to act, ready to literally lay their hands to things. It's sort of too responsive, right? So it often gets us into trouble. What other discussions or topics might we look to in order to read things into this discussion of Thumos? We could look at all the discussions of things related to honor. You know, for example, the virtues and vices concerned with honor or with social life. We can also look at discussions of how relationships work or expectations of honor, affection, reciprocity. My suggestion here is that we look primarily to the emotion or dynamic most associated with Thumos, which is anger, about which Aristotle tells us quite a lot, but never in one single place. So if we look across his works, Aristotle provides us with a quite sophisticated, arguably scientific, but also underdetermined account of anger, in which he talks about it in physical forms. He talks about it in terms of how the emotion itself works, primarily in rhetoric. And then he talks about it in moral terms. He usually uses the term orge, but, you know, arguably that's going to be a part of, not part, but a mode of Thumos. So we can ask ourselves, how does proairesis bear upon Thumos? Sometimes we're acting non-proairetically when we get angry and we do things. You know, that's one way of understanding akrasia. But we can also understand it in terms of our character, habituation, virtue and vice, with respect to emotions and actions oriented by certain basic goods that Thumos seems to be most centered on. Honor, contention or victory, security against danger, notions of right and wrong or justice, and affection or relationships. Aristotle famously tells us we're not praised or blamed, right, solely on the basis of whether we are or not, are or are not angry, but whether we feel and act rightly, how we habitually or characteristically behave in terms of anger. He puts forth an ideal of prautes, mildness, gentleness, which doesn't mean not getting angry. It means getting angry at the right time, with the right people, for the right reason, to the right extent. It's going to be rather forgiving, as he says, sun gnomikos, but it's going to get angry. And he faults those who don't get angry as having a defect. He talks about the slavish person, the anapododes, who puts up with insult and injury, the spiritless, anorgetos person who doesn't get angered and is considered foolish or simple. And he says people like this appear unable to defend themselves and to be willing to put up with having mud thrown on one. In the Eudaimon Ethics, he says that people of this sort take insult readily and are humble in the face of slights and belittling. And, you know, we can say that, well, some other people later on are going to see this as a good thing, but Aristotle definitely sees this as a bad thing. Thumos helps us do what we ought to do, not just for ourselves, but also for those who we are concerned with. There's some political and legal dimensions to anger as well for Aristotle. In Politics 5, it plays an important role in stasis and social breakdown, which shows us, you know, that we need to be attentive to how Thumos works. In Politics Book 7, he tells us that acts of timoresis and kolases, retaliation or retribution and punishment, if they're just, they do spring from virtue. And so there's something that's important for us. They're not really, you know, good in themselves, but they are necessary. They come from ananke, what we have to do. They have nobility only in a limited way. And he also, just to follow up on this bit about, you know, the legal dimensions, he does think that when people get angry, there's two things going on. One, they sometimes commit, you know, wrong actions, and we should be more forgiving towards those who do it in anger, provided it's not out of vice than those who like deliberately do wrong things. But he also thinks that anger can easily blind us and make us want to impose heavier penalties, because then we tend to think that everything people are doing is deliberately chosen as a vicious action. So that's more or less the story for Aristotle. I do want to say one thing about sort of an interlude here, one function of the Platonic thumos, which is not there in Plato himself, but in things that people have made of it sometimes. Some read into it a sort of mediating faculty which decides between, you know, reason as good and appetite or bad, or perhaps itself as bad. There's, you know, later on there's going to be a lot of discussions of something like this, and we call that the will, right? So some people have tried to read backwards into thumos something like the will. I don't think that actually works. And there isn't anything like that quite developed in Aristotle. Proairesis for Aristotle isn't the will as such. It's not even proairesis in Epictetus, right? When we look at peripatetic thinkers after Aristotle, we're kind of restricted because we don't have much from them, unfortunately. Theophrastus probably would have had some interesting contributions, given the projects of adding to Aristotle's works, as we see Cicero discussing. He did have a book on mental derangements and another on the passions. Presumably, we'd have seen some discussion there, but those are lost. Another important peripatetic who gets sucked into the literature, but we don't have anything by, is Hieronymus of Rhodes. He's cited by Plutarch. He may have been a main source for Plutarch's On Controlling Anger. Cicero brings him up here and there as well. We know that he gave some advice about treating anger like treating a fever, letting the swelling of spleen subside, so there's a physical aspect to it. What we can surmise is that the Aristotelians did follow up on this notion of thumos being something that we really need, something that's necessary for us in individual and social life, because we see Seneca bashing them constantly for this in argument after argument. Some of these are not things that Aristotle himself said, so presumably they're coming from people in the Peripatetic school. To do a little bit of an interlude, and I'm going to try to be very cognizant of time. So I've got till I got about 10 minutes left. I'm going to run through stuff very quickly then, and maybe we can talk about some of it later. The Epicureans don't have a lot to say about this, in part because we don't have very much from them. It is used as a term, thumos, by Philodemus, by contrast to orge. There's a distinction being made. He has to do a little bit of dancing around to explain how thumos, which is okay, orge, which is okay, orge fousike, is the same thing as what Metrodorus and Epicurus talked about as thumos, but we don't have their books discussing this. When we get to the Stoics, we have a very different account. There's a robust psychology developed, and the Stoics reject a faculty psychology, anything like the Platonic or Aristotelian psychology. With the exception of the eupathai, the Stoics view emotions as being thoughts or judgments about goods or evils. They're all excessive impulses opposed to or escaping reason. Orge or thumos don't have any sort of priority over the others. In Arius Didymus, and we see this also in Diogenes Laertes and Cicero and Tusculan Disputations, thumos is a term that gets used for a specific type of emotion in the register, interestingly, of epithumia. So they're working with a whole different way of understanding it. And he, Arius Didymus tells us that the Stoics actually viewed thumos is just one type of orge, the others being holos, menos, kotos, pikriai, and then there's a kai ta toi alta, so there's more as well. Seneca carries out a very extended analysis and rejection of anger, including Aristotelian arguments for it, both in his On Anger and in On Clemency. Epictetus mentions thumos a few times. Interestingly, in him, we can see that he does at least distinguish between two main ways of going bad. One is being like the, you know, beasts of prey, And that's being thumotic. Or you can be like, you know, sheep. And, you know, that seems to be more like epithumia. But he doesn't have any place for thumos. Marcus is one of the few people who references anything about anger in a good light. He references Theophrastus basically providing Aristotle's account of why Acrasia, although he's not mentioning Acrasia there, just doing wrong in respect of anger is not as bad as being motivated by desire. There is one important exception that we find out through Galen, and that is Posidonius. Posidonius gets called not a Stoic by the more orthodox Stoics, in part because he sees an important role for a tripartite psychology like that of Plato. So according to Galen, this is pretty true, Posidonius completely departed from these opinions. He did not think emotions are judgments nor supervenient judgments, but in everything he follows the ancient account and thinks produced by the spirited and appetitive parts. The education and virtue of this rational element is understanding of the things, as that of the charioteer is understanding of the instructions. Understanding does not get generated non-rational capacities of the soul any more than the horses. For proper virtue, he says, accrues from a kind of non-rational habituation. At least one Stoic who's taking that into account. And then we have Cicero. Cicero is an eclectic, as we know. Strangely, he thinks that the Aristotelian and Platonic school are basically on the same page at most points. He treats anger as something always bad. He does that in a number of different places, particularly in On Duties. And in Tusculan Disputations, he attacks the Peripatetics, saying that... for saying that nobody can order any rigid commands without some bitterness and anger, that an order should have anger, and Cicero rejects that. When we look at somebody like Plutarch, I'll go through Plutarch and then a bit of the others, and then we'll jump into just a very brief stuff about Christians. So Plutarch actually has a lot to say about thumos. And his overall approach is to reinforce and argue for the tripartite soul idea of Plato, argue for the importance of thumos and the thumoeides in moral life, but also to adapt useful Aristotelian doctrines and insights and to defend the Platonic position from the Stoics. So the texts that are particularly relevant to thumos or the tripartite soul or moral development would be On Moral Virtue, On Restraining Anger, On Tranquility of Mind, Platonic Questions number 9, and On Stoic Self-Contradictions. In On Moral Virtue, he says that Plato divides the soul into the rational part and emotional irrational part, which then is subdivided into the epithumetikon, which serves the body, and the thumoeides, which sometimes joins with reason and which contributes strength, as he says, isthus, and power or capacity, dunamis, to it. And then he says, Aristotle made use of Plato's structure, but reassigned the thumoeides to the epithumetikon on grounds that thumos is a type of epithumia, specifically orexis for retaliation. That's kind of sketchy right there, but you can see he's taking on the Aristotelian thing. And I'm going to skip down a little bit. He incorporates a number of identifiably Aristotelian doctrines. So he tells us, for example, moral virtue is a quality of the irrational. The irrational, being formed by reason, acquires this quality by habit, since reason does not wish to eradicate passion completely, but puts upon it some limit and implants the ethical virtues, which are not the absence of passion, but a due proportion and measure. Symmetrias pathon kai mesotetas. Right after that, he cites the Aristotelian distinction of pathos, dunamis, and hexis. And he also discusses akrasia and kratia. One of the tricks that Plutarch will do on occasion is take things right out of Aristotle and then attribute them to Plato or Socrates, you know, thereby sucking them back into the middle Platonic tradition. In Platonic Questions 9, he raises the question whether in the Republic, when there's this symphonia or harmonia of higher, lower, and middle, what should be in the middle? And he rejects the argument that some people apparently were making that because the logistikon is the kurion dunamin, which sounds kind of stoic, it needs to be in the middle. Instead, he reasserts that the thumo eides has the function of ruling over and punishing. So kratunti, kolazunti, epithumia when it disobeys reason. And there's some interesting musical speculations there as well, having to do with the relation of different strings to each other. He also, and I, this is something I haven't gone into enough. I haven't looked at the biographies much, except for the biography of Alexander. He talks about Alexander as a typical thumoeides person, driven by philotimia, prone to rages. And he brings up one particular example at the Battle of the River Granicus, where the Greek mercenaries sued for mercy, but that Alexander, under the influence of Thumos more than his reason, charged foremost at them. So in Plutarch, we clearly have, you know, a recuperation of a tripartite soul. We see this also in Alcinous and Albinus Apuleius. In Heracles of Alexandria and his commentary on the golden verses of Pythagoras. And then there's others who we should describe not as Platonic per se, but more eclectic. Philo of Alexandria is one example. In his case, the thumos isn't something that should be serving us. Rather, it's something we should get rid of. But he does have a tripartite soul. Galen says he's not a Platonist because he doesn't like the Platonists of his time, but he does accept the tripartite soul, associates, again, thumos with the heart. Let's see. Let me skip ahead a little bit here. When we get to Christian thinkers, we're looking at a framework that has a lot of other things being added into it. The writers that are, you know, well-versed in philosophy are going to and are discussing thumos or discussing anger are going to be referencing everybody that's out there as much as they can. So somebody like Lactantius, for example, you see him engaging specifically with the Platonists, Aristotelians, Stoics, Epicureans, Cicero, and then proposing in his view, yet better view about this. He tells us, for example, in the Divine Institutes that both the Stoics and the Peripatetics are getting things wrong when it comes to anger. Ira, cupiditas, and libido are all given to us to be ordered rightly. If they pass their limits and begin to be too great, they pervert their nature and are changed into diseases and vices. And there's further discussion about the distinction between just and unjust anger. Lactantius actually attributes anger to God. Just anger in the on the anger of God. In some of these other thinkers, we see a much clearer embrace of the tripartite soul. We can and this arrangement where the thumotic part is supposed to be listening to the logike part, but there's also an understanding that the logike part can be screwed up too, and requires some sort of fixing or healing or divine grace. So I'll just mention quickly Basil in Homily 10. He says, how might we avoid the harm that comes from yielding to anger, persuading our wrath to await the guidance of our reason? The irascible part of the soul is serviceable to us in many acts of virtue. It gives us aid against sin. Anger is the sinew of the soul, he says, which provides it with vigor for the accomplishments of good works. And he tells us that we have to arouse our anger against the evil one. Unless we hate him as fiercely as we deserve, we're not going to do the right things, and we're not going to have courage. Evagrius Ponticus and John Cassian, closely connected to each other because of the eight capital vices, or in Evagrius, the eight bad thoughts. They both embrace a tripartite Platonic soul. He tells us that virtue in the irascible part is courage, but also patience, and this allows us not to fear the enemies and eagerly to endure afflictions. He tells us again that against thoughts coming from the the appetites. The boiling heat of the irascible part directed against this is extremely useful. Cassian, in his conference with Abbot Abraham, tells us that the irascible part can have all these different things going wrong with it, and we need to fix that. And there's a number of other people bringing up similar things, like Maximus Confessor, Pseudo Damascus, Philotheus of Sinai. I'm going to finish by mentioning one person who's going to play a role later on and get mentioned by Thomas, and that's somebody who's not really taking a Platonic perspective, but a more Aristotelian perspective, and that's John Damascus in On the Orthodox Faith. In book two, there's two chapters where he's going to discuss the faculties, and he's got parts of the soul. There's the vegetative part, which includes the vital, the spermatic or generative, and the nutritive. Then there's the animal part of the soul, which includes appetite or orexis, which is thumos and epithumia, sense and impulsive movement, and then there's the rational part of the soul. The irrational is divided into what listens to reason and what doesn't, but that's not a division between epithumia and thumos, any more than it is for the earlier writers that I've been mentioning. It's a distinction between the vegetative part of the soul. All of the animal part of the soul can obey reason, including epithumia. He tells us in chapter 22 that passion is a sensible activity of the appetitive faculty, depending on presentation to the mind of something good or bad, which sounds a little stoic. From good things, we get desire. From bad things, we get anger. So thumos is activated, you could say, when we're facing some sort of threat or some sort of something going wrong. And he tells us that anger or thumos is an energy manifested by the part of the soul where anger resides, whereas passion involves these two divisions of the soul and the whole body when it's impelled to action by anger. So, you know, this has been very sketchy and running through things, and not going into great detail about them. But what you can see is that, you know, after Aristotle, there are challenges that are completely rejecting any sort of faculty psychology, right? But then there's all these interesting projects of people trying to use Plato's tripartite distinction, trying to preserve some role for thumos, a little bit more leery of it perhaps than Plato himself is, but also bringing in Aristotelian insights and sometimes Stoic insights whenever they're helpful. And there's no one single one that we could point to, not even Plutarch, I think, as the representative of this. But there's a long continuity. And again, it's unfortunate we've lost so much literature, because it would be nice to see what some of these other people that are just mentioned are doing with it, like to see what Posidonius actually wrote instead of getting it from Galen. But I think that there is a story there that shows that, just to bring this to a close, we've got a Platonic tripartite soul, thumos, a major part. We have Aristotelian reworking of this that maintains some centrality for anger, some centrality for thumos, but doesn't tell us enough about it. And then we have a whole history of people trying to make sense of this in relation to the preoccupations of their own time and other things like the Christian thinkers bringing concerns, you know, coming from Scripture or Christian practice into that. So that's all I've got.
I have two questions. Thank you very much for this very comprehensive approach. One concerns like the deduction of Plato, the spirit part.
Yeah.
So it looks like it's a sort of left over. So in a way, that cannot be included under appetites and under reason. So there is something on the way. So the first question would be then, what's the object of thumos? Or is it just like a thrust? So that would be like more towards the end.
Yeah.
Looking at the end, it looks like, very broadly speaking, the notion of thumos tend to disappear as that kind of thrust. So we have the, to go towards the ages, the distinction between voluntas fluctuatio and voluntas of natura.
Yeah.
So the idea would be like thumos is preserved under ira, and anger, but it looks like that's not what Plato meant, all that Plato meant.
Yeah.
So it looks like the notion of demos is lost. And also you mentioned, for instance, Maximus, the professor, who, as you know, thinks about Gethsemane, the fight, so to speak, between the two wills of Christ in Gethsemane, and he distinguished between Theleo and Ulysses.
Yeah.
Ulysses and Theleo. So where is Themos there? So again, the two questions would be, if you talk about what the object of Themos could be in Plato, and then is it the case that the notion of Themos gets somehow lost, and it's only tied to the irascible, like, anger?
So, for Plato, it's definitely not a leftover, because it plays a vital role. You have to have your thumos cultivated in order to impose the will of reason on the appetites. And the appetites, you know, are totally unable to regulate themselves. They grow super large if we indulge them, all that sort of stuff. And so, I mean, this is something that you see coming through the Platonic tradition. And you see it in Maximus, who tells us that you have to cultivate this thumotic part precisely so that you can, like with Evagrius and John Cassian, so you can use it against the devil and you know, all those sorts of things. And cultivating the thumotic part for these Christian thinkers also means cultivating patience. So that's a sort of proper conditioning of it. But it's not a leftover. It plays an important role, but thumos is sort of a dangerous ally, right? Because if it starts, and you know, Plato talks about it as being an ally of the rational part. If it starts to think that it's more important than the rational part, or if the rational part was never really fully developed, I suppose, properly, then thumos becomes the thing that really drives the person. And they may be somebody very different than somebody who's just seeking money or pleasure, but they're in some respects more dangerous. So I wouldn't say that there's any sort of leftover part to it. Now, does it sort of drop out of the picture? Yes and no. And part of that, I think, does have to do with language. So where do we see these discussions going on more? Well, in the Greeks rather than the Latin speakers. But there are some who are still considering Lactantius, for example. Although you could say, well, he's very early, right? But the thumotic part still, you know, plays a role. I mean, think about Thomas Aquinas, right? You have the orexis, and it's got, you know, good Aristotelian three modes, right? And if you look at the commentary on Nicomachean Ethics, boulesis is will, right? Thumos is the irascible orexis, and then in Summa Theologiae, he tells us that the irascible orexis is called irascible not because it only pertains to anger, but because that's one of the main modes of it. It also has to do with the difficult good in general, right? So that's what he's rolling thumos into. I don't know enough about other medieval Aristotelians to say much about that, unfortunately. Now, you brought up another term that plays a role with these Greeks, thelema, right? Because there's a lot of discussion of the freedom of the will that takes place. And is that the same thing as boulesis, or is it something different? Like in John Damascene, these are two different things. Cassian has discussions of the freedom of the will as well in the conferences with the abbots. Thumos, I don't think, was ever something that we would want to say is the will. It's always this driving appetite that can serve us. Can you say it has ideas of its own? Sort of, you know. It wants honor. It retaliates against injustice, insults, threats, things like that. Aristotle, you know, like I said, says that it syllogizes, but its syllogizing is entirely dependent on what phantasia or logos provides to it, it seems. But it isn't simply reducible to ira. Or sometimes when these people are using ira, they're using it in the terms of thumos.
Yeah, this idea that it's sort of it doesn't look like we have a Latin word that corresponds to spirit, but it's like
right
packed in different pieces, like you're yeah. talking about desire and everything. So in that sense, it's lost. But as you say, it might not be lost in the sense that it's kind of preserved through other elements. No, but once you have desire. Appetites, the irascible desires, and reason. What would seem thumos?
Yeah.
Add, and what would be the Latin word for thumos? For that remainder, so just to have a
yeah. Yeah. Well, what would be, better put, what would be a Latin term that wouldn't be so ambiguous that it could be reduced just to, like, ira as anger rather than thumos? Yeah. Or iracundia or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, so there was a lot of different elements to this discussion. I just wanted to follow up on the question of an object of thumos.
Mm.
I think, so first, I just want to say that it's really impressive, all the text that you looked at here and brought together a lot of material together, and I think it's a promising project, and I think there's definitely a lot to dig through here and figure out what to look for. I think one interesting question to bring to the table is kind of what the ontology of thumos is.
Yeah.
And picking up from the discussion of the irascible appetite, there it seems like you've got a distinction between different kinds of desires. Desires or appetites are being distinguished by reference to what their desire is for, what their appetite's for. And then you've got some creatures have an appetite or desire for certain kinds of things, and that those sorts of desires are called, those belong to the irascible appetite, which is this sort of more basic capacity
right.
to find something desirable, and then there's the occurrent desires of wanting to do such and such.
Yeah.
So one thing that I didn't see you focusing on, but I'm wondering if you have thoughts on as you look at these different texts, is like what the ontology of thumos is in these texts. In Plato, it's this part of the soul, and that's a dunamis, and what
yeah.
is that exactly? But in Aristotle, maybe it's a type of desire.
That's it, yeah.
That, I'm wondering if you think that, you mentioned the Stoics seem to think of it as a type of orge, and I think one interesting question to be brought to it is, what's the ontology of thumos in these
yeah.
texts?
So, two things. First, thanks for the compliment, but it's also sort of like the thing where you look at it from the inside and you're like, wow, this is just a mess. So I'm glad it looks good from the outside. Now the ontology, yeah. So with the Platonic tradition, it's a part of the soul, right? It's got something quite robust. With the Aristotelian tradition, it's a type of orexis, and I understand that people translate orexis as appetite or desire. I think we should translate it as affectivity more broadly, because it's clear that the pathe are also examples of orexis, despite Aristotle saying that orexis is just divided into three types, because he also, he's got the passions or the emotions, and then there's proeresis is also orexis dienoetike, right? So clearly it's this very broad term, and it orients us towards things. Animals have most of it. Children have most of it and will develop into having. Well, actually, children have boulesis, he says. And then, sort of this whole part of us that does respond to things, makes us feel things. And thumos is just one part of that, or not part, one mode of that, right? One manifestation of that. But it's a fairly, as far as ontology goes, it's not like thumos just arises, right? And so we've got this thumos, this thumos, this thumos. No, there's thumos, and it runs throughout the course of our life. So there has to be some sort of, ontological status to that.
Right.
And then when we get to the Stoics, there isn't anything like that. And when I mentioned that it's just a species of orgē, well, orgē is just a species of emotion in general, and emotions are all thoughts that have an affective correlate to themselves. So they're all determinations of to hegemonikon, the ruling part of ourselves. There's no faculty psychology there. With the Epicureans, it's too unclear what exactly mind means for them. Unless we discover some texts, it's not going to help. Now, in these later thinkers, you're seeing an attempt to try to take the Platonic and Aristotelian accounts and, you know, fuse them together in some productive way and respond to the Stoics. And maybe also bring in some considerations coming from scripture, things like that, which complicate it yet more, right?
I have a separate question. I'll make sure everybody gets a question before asking. The follow-up question is, to the initial one, is I think it might be easier to talk about a purpose of Thumos or a unified purpose and identity for Thumos in the Republic if you say something slightly different from what you did said about its function.
Yeah.
Its function, as I understand it, is, as Socrates first presents it, is self-defense. Coming to reason's aid against the appetites is one half of self-defense.
Yeah, yeah.
Not self-defense against, say, wild animals, self-defense against oneself.
Yeah, yeah.
And the appetites, the wild animals within.
I like that. And, you know, one other aspect of that, too, is, so it's not just purely negative, right?
Right. I mean, like, why would
it's part of how you integrate the self.
Right. But why would the same faculty be associated with honor, shame, victory, fear, and anger?
Yeah.
And the answer, well, and I take it that part of the answer is this is the fight, this is the closest thing we have still in our kind of modern psychological ontology is something like the fight or flight mechanism.
Yeah.
It overcomes fear to let you fight. So in that sense, it's a faculty. Anger helps you overcome fear. But also, it overcomes these through shame,
yeah.
Which I take it is conceptualized there in the Republic as internalized anger.
Yeah. Yeah, especially in that account, you know, the guy saying, fine, you want to look at the corpses, go ahead, you know.
Right. Yeah. And one reason why you might think honor is, this is, and I take it this is why, in a way, you think of the same thing associated with embarrassment or no, stronger than embarrassment, with shame, with the thing associated with fight or flight as, if someone insults you, in a sense, it's an attack upon your person.
Yeah.
And honor wouldn't stand for that if it's an unfair insult.
Yeah. Well, and it can also arise when you need to protect others too that you're
yes.
identifying with or responsible for, and you know this account actually fits in really well with the later, Christian thinkers who are trying to harness this thumotic part precisely to, they'll say things like, well, John Cassian, for example, the only time you should be angry is when you're angry with yourself, you know, don't get angry with other people. That's always bad, no matter how you find some way to justify it, right? But you can certainly be angry at your own faults. So in that case, the other sort of external thing almost drops away, and what you're talking about becomes the only important part.
Thank you very much. Exploring this probably understood ontological issue.
Oh, yeah.
That did come up. I want to suggest that there's an important distinction in Aristotle, and I'm wondering whether it figures at all in the later tradition, between what one might think of as the approach to the emotions, anger, etc., of the state, the psychological state, from the standpoint of natural science.
Yeah.
And the approach from what you might probably think of as the ethical point of view. Now, I realize that these things can get mixed up,
yeah.
particularly in the later tradition, but I want to say Aristotle is pretty clear. So if he's, there's very little about it, but as you suggest, there's some in the biological works
yeah.
about anger, relates to something what Jason was saying. In bulls, for example, they're that the final cause of their anger, and this had nothing to do with any ethical purpose or anything like that, is protection of their territory.
Yeah.
They storm around and protect, and this is true in other animals as well. But again, has no ethical dimension whatsoever. That's a natural final cause. Then you start talking about, is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it a bad thing? How do you control it? And all of that. That now you can't violate natural the truths of nature. But on the other hand, that's not your interest.
Yeah.
In discussing this subject, and so it's not going to be settleable by natural science. Though of course you couldn't ignore it in talking about the issue. And I'm just wondering whether anybody else besides Aristotle
makes that distinction.
Is clear on
about
this.
The levels.
Yeah, I mean obviously in your discussion, it's taken over into ethical issues. Okay, and so that's kind of the dominant.
There's a tendency to, like you were saying, blur the levels into each other. I mean, and the Timaeus, I don't know if this would have happened if the Timaeus had been around, you know, because then anger gets associated with the heart. Like Galen, for example, who, you know, he sees mental problems, for example, and he's interested in diagnosing, like, people getting too angry. He ties it together with the function of the heart and the pneuma, and how it's going throughout the rest of the body. And you're right. Aristotle makes this, you know, the natural scientist looks at anger as a boiling of blood around the heart.
If it's health, the issue, okay, that brings it back into the area of natural
science. But health and ethics for Galen overlap with each other.
Well, I guess that's,
And the same for any of these others who are bringing up the physical parts of it. But actually, I mean, this leads us to something kind of, you know, so Aristotle, Plato, all these other people, they say, well, you know, animals have thumos, children have thumos, you know, and you wonder, well, what's the difference between just purely animal thumos, like the wolf defending its territory, or who knows, maybe biting another wolf in play and then it gets too serious, and children doing that, and then how does it transition into an adult thumos that's concerned with abstract things like, you know, somebody's, you know, raising my mortgage rates. Ooh, that makes me mad, you know.
It's insulting and dishonorable and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, there's this, you know, happening here. There's this happening here. There's this happening here. And there's no developmental account from how you get from one to the other, which I'd love to see. But, you know, and I'm not even sure if we can reconstruct it adequately from the text that we have. So... But yeah, it's a good concern. I think most of these thinkers just saw the physical and the psychological or ethical as interpenetrating each other. I mean, for the Stoics, there's no room for anything other than that. So.
Yeah, something you said in response to Jason kind of pushed my hand up into the thinker realm. Thank you for this. I mean, wonderful, comprehensive. My question is about... You mentioned that anger can also be aroused in defense of others.
Yeah.
Where does Aristotle or Plato say anything?
In the definition of anger for Aristotle.
So, insofar as, how about this? I'll rephrase it as a request for information. At what point, or if ever, do you see a transition or awareness in these thinkers to, when do they show any awareness for what we today would call, like, impartial anger? Like sort of anger on behalf of something that doesn't affect you at all, but affects.
Aristotle would call that indignation. That's nemesis. That's in Book Two of the Rhetoric.
But nemesis is egocentric. It's still defined in terms of oligorein, is it not?
Defined in what?
In terms of oligorein so anger orge is a response to oligorein, to being brought low. By
nemesis is discussed at a different point in Book Two of the Rhetoric. It's a different emotion. But to go to the question of, well, where is the sort of being concerned with others, that's right there in the Rhetoric Book 2 definition of anger. It's quite complex, you know, and it includes, you know, you know, the oligorrhea takes place with respect to oneself or those for whom one is concerned or whom is one is connected.
Yeah, to whom one is connected, right?
Yeah.
I'm talking about, so how do I get, and so at what point do these fingers show awareness of the ability to get angry on behalf of
they don't.
A stranger killed by the police?
Well, you do that by identifying
anger
in some
light of distant
yeah,
others,
I mean, you right? identify in some way with them. There's no, I mean, we can think that we're like being totally impartial, but that doesn't mean we are. Why are we concerned with, you know, these particular people being affected in this way and then not with the thousands of other cases? Well, because we somehow, I mean, this is sort of a, I'm not saying that I actually endorse this account, but this is a possible response to that. And Aristotle doesn't think that anger does that sort of thing. He does talk about, you know, indignation or nemesis later on in book two, and that does some of that work, you know. But anger, I mean, Aristotle's account of the emotions is underdeveloped, you know. The main thing is in rhetoric, book two, and he's primarily interested in arming the rhetorician with what he needs to know. We've, you know, there may be some really great examples in all these lost, you know, works, you know, what would it be? On the passions or things like that that we see in these catalogs in Diogenes Laertius, but we don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I ask because, so I mean, as far as I can tell, like the central discussion, maybe not so much the Timaeus, but the, you know, where like Thumos gets born in Republic 4,
yeah.
It seems more or less entirely concerned with like maintaining one's social position. Right, it's like the part of the soul that
monitors
your social position and your.
No, I think it's a mistake to try to reduce it down to one thing. It's got a range of different objects. We might be able to provide some account of how these different objects are all connected to each other, but we have to. Any explanation that we give has to give at least an account of the different objects that are named specifically, and one of them is, you know, frustration at being hungry or cold. Aristotle talks about that again too in Rhetoric Book 2. So there's a lot of difference, a lot of things that can rile up the Thumos, you could say, right? And there, you know, there's I don't see any reason to exclude the possibility in Plato of getting upset on account of others. As a matter of fact, Plato. At one point in time, I tabulated all the cases where anger is referenced or discussed. And most of them are sort of self-regarding. People are getting ticked off at each other. But you people get upset on account of other people not sharing their values, you know, not seeing the, you know, Kalon or an ice throne as the same thing. That comes up in the Euthyphro, the Gorgias. In the Protagoras, people get angry at those who claim to have skills or knowledge they don't possess.
Clause 10, it's impossible not to be outraged when you see these young atheists all their lives. They've been.
Yeah, I mean, and you could say, well, maybe these are all just examples of people, like, projecting their own, you know, stuff onto these other people. You should be like me, you know. But I don't know. I think there's a
no,
more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My apologies to
those questions. Well, thanks very much. I'm glad to get off the hot seat.